From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. And we're following the latest from South Carolina today as the cleanup begins after those incredible rains.
At least it is finally sunny, Meghna. We're also following hearings in the Senate today. The top U.S. commander in Afghanistan said that the airstrike on the Doctors Without Borders hospital in Kunduz was a mistake. And General John Campbell said the raid had been requested by Afghan troops who had come under fire. Meanwhile, on another battlefield where the U.S. is involved, Syria, NATO now says Russian ground forces will join the fight in Syria, a claim that Russia denies. Russia has been conducting airstrikes in Syria. It says that those airstrikes are against ISIS and other extremist groups, although the U.S. says Russia is also attacking the Syrian rebels, which the U.S. supports. Jane Harman is a former Democratic congresswoman who served on the Armed Services, Intelligence, and Homeland Security Committees, now the president and CEO of the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars in Washington, and she's with us. Jane Harman, welcome back to Here and Now.
Thank you, Jeremy.
What would it mean if Russian ground troops were to get involved in the fight in Syria?
Well, Russia has a plan in Syria, and we don't. And that plan includes certainly air assets. But if they have people on the ground, I think they'll be more effective in accomplishing what seems to be their primary objective, which is protecting Bashar Assad.
Why is that their primary objective, in your view, just to protect Assad and not to fight ISIS, which they've also said that they're doing?
Well, they may be also fighting ISIS to some extent, but I think it's been clear that they view Syria as a patron state of Russia. They've over time historically supplied arms to Syria. They use a deep water port in Syria. They're owed a lot of money and want it repaid. And they're occupying a vacuum that has existed because the U.S. And Europe has been so cautious in the region.
How do you think the U.S. should respond to what Russia is doing?
Well, I think the U.S. needs a plan. We don't have a plan. I don't think it's just responding to what they're doing. I think it is carrying out what we have said we want to achieve, which is to degrade and destroy ISIS. And we've also said that removing Bashar is part of our objective. I think now we're saying that can be a part of a peace process, a political settlement on the ground. But I think we should continue to do things to degrade and destroy ISIS. And yesterday, at least yesterday's news, reported that we're upping our game a bit by empowering 3,000 to 5,000 Arab fighters who would join more than 20,000 Kurdish combatants in an offensive. And we're putting pressure on ISIS in Raqqa, which is their nominal headquarters in Syria. These are all moves in North Syria. This is not where most of the Russian focus is.
But can the U.S. really achieve its objectives while relying on fighters that are not U.S. troops? John McCain, Senator John McCain, has said there should be U.S. troops on the ground in Syria.
Well, there are U.S. troops on the ground, a very limited number of U.S. troops who are doing special missions and who are helping to some extent to coordinate the troops that we've trained. Again, our training mission has not been successful. We've been more cautious than effective because we were worried that arms and people would be fighting for the wrong objectives. And we've tried to have this very carefully bifurcated plan where we were training troops to go against ISIS and not directly against Assad. And now Russia has a well-developed plan, and they're executing it. You could almost say that this is the Putin Diaries Part 3. Part 1, where the two provinces of Georgia, the country, in 2008, which Russia basically controls. Part 2 is eastern Ukraine, and this is Part 3, which is Syria, the client state.
Well, is the U.S. going to have to at least come to terms with the Russian idea that Assad stays in power in order for there to be some end to some peaceful end to this conflict? Is the U.S. going to have to accept that Assad remains in power?
Well, that's a great question. I actually don't think the Russians or the Iranians, who are active in Syria through their proxy groups, have as a long-term objective keeping Bashar in power. They want They want to be able to control who comes next in Syria. And in that way, the irony is that we have the same end game, which is a transition to a government without Bashar. You could call it Bashar change, not regime change. And Bashar, I think, is a clear demonstrated war criminal who used chemical weapons and barrel bombs on his own people. And he's a weak leader. And I don't think he has the legitimacy to stay in power in Syria. But Russia wants to decide who comes next. And Iran, through its proxy groups, want to have a big influence there. And all of this is happening because there was a vacuum. And I just while I applaud the fact that President Obama doesn't want another major land war in Asia, in the Middle East, and there's no U.S. support for that, I'm disappointed that the excessive caution and the failure to follow the advice of a number of leaders, including Hillary Clinton, John Kerry, Dave Petraeus, and others, when they were in positions to advise the president 3 years ago, has led to this appearance and maybe the reality that we don't have a plan.
But a lot of Americans also look at what happened in other countries that started with the Arab Spring, places like Libya, and say, yeah, Muammar Gaddafi was a terrible guy, but look at Libya now. It's a disaster.
I agree. I'm not suggesting we remove Bashar and then leave the country to itself. I don't think that's a strategy. I think, task number one is to degrade and destroy ISIS. I think that is the right objective, and we're upping our game a bit to do that. Task number two is to support a political process in the country that would lead to Bashar change and replace it with something responsible. We never did that part in Libya. We were part of a European-led mission to remove Gaddafi or to support the groups in Libya who wanted to remove Gaddafi. And then that was it. We thought that somehow good governance would arise, and it obviously didn't. Same thing didn't happen in Egypt.
I want to ask you about one more thing in the minute we have left here, and that is the refugees who have just decided to leave Syria. We spoke yesterday with Andrew Bacevich, the military analyst, mm-hmm. and here's what he said the American response should be right now.
Where we can make a difference is in doing something to assist the people who have suffered so grievously as a consequence of this horrendous historical tragedy.
Now, the U.S. is now prepared to accept 10,000 refugees in the next year. He says that's inadequate. What are your thoughts?
It's inadequate. I think we have to have a plan to accept more. Europe has to have a plan to accept more. Canada, which is considering it, should accept more. Let's understand that this human tragedy is not all our fault, but earlier action could have prevented a lot of it. And I, by the way, endorse this notion of a safe zone in Syria, a safe zone for human beings, not a safe zone for a training mission. And let's just call Russia's bluff. Let them try to block us from creating a safe zone using air power and those who help us on the ground to protect millions of people still in harm's way.
Jane Harman, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Twice a year, a 6-mile stretch of the Cuyahoga River is dredged, clearing sludge from the bottom of the river in order for ships to pass. Now, the Cuyahoga is a critical shipping route in the U.S., carrying raw materials to Ohio factories and their finished products back to the Port of Cleveland on Lake Erie and then up to the Great Lakes and out to the Atlantic and then to the rest of the world. And when the Cuyahoga gets dredged, there's enough sediment to fill about 22,000 dump trucks. The sludge used to go into Lake Erie, but Ohio Governor John Kasich says that kind of dumping will be banned by 2020. So now there are some alternative ideas about what to do with all the muck. Brian Bull from Here and Now contributor WCPN in Cleveland reports.
Outside the ArcelorMittal steel plant in Cleveland, a crane dumps a murky gray soup onto a barge parked on the Cuyahoga. To most people, this cocktail scraped off the bottom of the river is sludge. But to Jason Ziss.
This is good material. This is real nice stuff.
Ziss is the business development director for Kurtz Brothers, a Cleveland area construction material company. The Port of Cleveland hired Kurtz Brothers to store sludge in what's called a containment disposal facility. Their CDF near the shore of Lake Erie looks like a 34-acre holding tank of ponds and lagoons. Geese roam the site. Pumps filter out the water.
We just want to keep moving the water, keep drying this material out, get it to be into a workable form, and then start processing it and putting it into reuse applications or disposing of it on site for permanent disposal.
At the end of the process, superfine silt that's contaminated with decades of toxic chemicals like PCBs will be stored here indefinitely. But the dried-out gravelly stuff, about 50 to 70% of the gathered sediment, can be mixed with concrete or used as filler in landscaping and construction.
So it looks like, there you go. I'll push it around.
Will Friedman, president of the Port Authority, keeps a jar of dredged and dried sediment in his office. He says this batch came from a stretch of the Cuyahoga River upstream of the contaminated industrial area. He says it's been used to cap a brownfield site and mark a nature trail.
There's a misconception that what comes up out of the river is sort of glowing sludge. That's not the case. It actually just looks like sand and gravel.
But so far, demand for this repurposed sediment has been modest. Jason Ziss from Kurtz Brothers says that may be the case for some time.
As we learn how to process and manage sediment more efficiently, we hope to then, you know, increase our bottom line. But right now, it's slim, if any.
There are still possibilities with dredged river muck across the region, though, says Ohio EPA spokeswoman Heidi Griesmer.
I've heard the phrase, the best farmland in Ohio is on the bottom of Lake Erie, because the sediment that is dredged out of the Maumee River is so nutrient-rich that it may be able to be used on farm fields in place of manure or other things.
Griesmer says the state is funding $10 million in pilot projects across Ohio to fire up interest in dredged sediment, which means when dredging starts again this fall, some of that material could end up, well, just about anywhere. For Here and Now, I'm Brian Bull in Cleveland.
After last week's mass shooting at a community college in Southern Oregon, the president and the candidates hoping to succeed him are talking about guns. Yesterday, Democrat Hillary Clinton called for expanded background checks. And this morning, Republican Marco Rubio told Matt Lauer on NBC's Today Show that gun control would have done nothing to prevent the massacre.
We need to start examining why it is that people are taking violent action, not what they're using to commit the violent act with. And we have two issues in this country. One is mental illness, which we need to begin to address more seriously, as opposed to stigmatizing it or in some cases trying to put it aside. And that's a societal thing that we need to confront as a society and a country. And the other, of course, is why have we become so violent?
For some perspective on this debate, we go far from the U.S. to Australia. A mass shooting there almost 20 years ago prompted that country to change its gun laws, and it hasn't had a mass shooting since. Tim Fischer was deputy prime minister at the time. We spoke with him last year, and I asked him about the turning point in Australia back in 1996 during what's called the Port Arthur Massacre.
The Sunday afternoon, it was a tourist picnic area and cafeteria and museum. And suddenly this young person picked up a weapon with multi-firing capability and slaughtered some 35 people. And it was the catalyst for John Howard, our Prime Minister at the time, and I was his Deputy Prime Minister, to take it to the state governments that we now needed to harmonise gun laws, to step away from the pathway advocated by the NRA of laissez-faire, and to have a sensible set of gun controls without taking away the right for people to have recreational shooting, sporting shooting, Olympic shooting, along with farmers and ranchers having their requirements as well.
And for comparison, by the way, 35 killed at Port Arthur. There were 32 killed at Virginia Tech in 2007, 27 in Newtown, Connecticut. That includes the gunman back in 2012, and 13 killed at Columbine. So there must have just been absolute national shock at 35 killed.
Yes, it was. But nevertheless, it was a very difficult issue to prosecute in the public square. There was bitter opposition. I was hung in effigy at a public meeting at a place called Gympie in Queensland. It was a pretty ugly scene, a very wild meeting, noisy meeting, but ultimately a meeting that was swung by a 12-year-old teenage student standing up and arguing the case for common sense and arguing that it wasn't taking away everybody's guns, but was providing a new template of gun safety, a new template where essentially the suburbs were being drained of the semi-automatics and automatics. And we've turned a corner. There has not been one gun massacre in Australia since 1996. That does not mean that there may not be in the future, but it will come after a couple of thousand people's lives have been saved. Various people estimate around 200 lives a year annually as a direct consequence of the firearms legislation here in Australia.
Well, tell us exactly what you did. And let's start with the semi-automatic restrictions. What are they exactly?
It essentially took out the certain size shotguns. It took out semi-automatics and automatics from being legally available to people, sporting rifles and other 22s and even more bolt action type were permissible on farm, were permissible in sporting shooters and recreational shooting clubs and hunting and the like. And there is no numerical restriction on the number of rifles. But on top of that, you were required to have a shooter's license issued by each state government after you've done a preliminary test. And that's obviously held against a harmonised set of registers across Australia. And that, I understand, is what is feared most in some ways, is having both a shooter's license scheme and a weapons registration scheme, the two big asks here in Australia. They were legislated for within the 12 months following the massacre at Port Arthur, adopted along with a gun buyback scheme, and the result is plain to see and cannot be denied by the NRA.
Well, and tell us about that gun buyback, because we've had gun buybacks in the United States, but this was a mandatory national gun buyback.
Involving about $500 million, involving a added levy. It greatly reduced accidental deaths by guns, and homicide deaths and suicide deaths.
But there must have been people in Australia who did not sell back their guns, people that maybe shouldn't have even had their guns in the first place, whether they be criminals or whatever.
No legislation can be adopted without someone breaking the law, and some have been apprehended in breaking the law. But it made a difference in two ways. It essentially, it did take out the semi-automatics, the oversized, overpowered weapons from the suburbs of Australia. It also caused people to think, well, do I really need a gun? If I do, I'll apply and get it. But if I don't really need it, I won't go down that pathway. And so we really did walk away from a policy of more and more guns. And we did so perhaps recalling some of the comments that many have made, including Wendy Whitmire from the gun control group Mums Demand Action in the USA. If more guns made us safer, the US would be the safest nation in the world. You are not. You are 10 to 15 times more likely to be shot dead in the USA per capita than Australia. And by the way, you are even safer in Italy than the USA with regard to guns when looked at like for like on a per capita basis.
We're speaking with Tim Fischer, former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia. Tim Fischer, one of the things you did was add a 28-day waiting period for people who wanted to buy guns. Tell us about that.
It was a cooling-off period. It was the complete opposite of having no background checks at gun shows. And if the U.S. was to do anything, surely it should reinstate that and stand up to the NRA, which risks being completely put offside with its own supporters and the community at large the next time a massive massacre, gun massacre, occurs. You've got to face down such bad anomalies as there being no background check whatsoever for anyone who wants to rock up to a gun show. It just builds on builds and builds the number of guns around, and it has led indeed to people carrying guns still being killed in shootouts.
But I can hear a gun control advocate listening to this and saying, well, it's easier said than done. In this country, there's such opposition to that. There's a strong feeling by gun owners and even non-gun owners that people should have a right to bear arms in this country, and that anything that infringes on that is against the Constitution. How did you manage to overcome that hurdle in Australia to the extent that the same feelings exist there?
Jeremy, that's a good question, and we took the debate to the public square. We stood up at meeting after meeting, John Howard, Prime Minister, myself as Deputy Prime Minister and leader of a party with particular membership from country areas and members and senators from country areas, including many from Queensland, went to meeting after meeting. And that's the only way you'll turn the tide. That and, sadly, a massacre that goes beyond the pale, a massacre that hits up towards 100 dead. No intelligent person can justify allowing no check whatsoever for people to buy guns in the 21st century.
But were you worried for your own political future by getting up and standing up in those town meetings and saying what you did?
Yes, it was tough, and we had a swing against the government at the subsequent elections for a couple of reasons, of which guns was probably not one of those reasons, all things considered. But yes, I was bitterly attacked. I was directly attacked. I was hung in effigy. But some said, look, you're a Vietnam veteran, Tim Fisher. You're a rancher or farmer background. You, above all, should be defending our rights to unrestricted size of weapons, number of weapons, and a laissez-faire approach on guns. I am a Vietnam veteran. I weighed the pros and cons and supported John Howard and the harmonized legislation because I could see this was Australia's chance to jump through the hoops, take some pain, withdraw private property from individuals, but pay them just compensation. The result is there for everyone to see. On any calculation, at least 10 times, and on some calculations, up to 15 times safer than the streets of the USA and places like Duncan, Oklahoma, where a young Australian jogging along peacefully was cut down and slaughtered by guns in the USA not so long ago.
And we should remind people, by the way, that you are a gun owner even to this day.
Yes, I am, happily, and use a gun on the farm. And not so much for recreational reasons, but for essential reasons, with livestock needing to be put down and rabbit and fox control. And so be it. I am a happy owner of guns, a rancher down under, a Vietnam veteran, but one that fully supports the harmonized laws that have made a huge difference here in Australia, made Australia so much safer than the USA, who's still has... this incredible circumstance where you can have no background checks applied to a person buying a gun, almost any kind of gun, at a gun show in the USA.
Tim Fisher is a former member of the Australian Parliament, former Deputy Prime Minister of Australia, speaking to us via Skype from his ranch in Australia. Tim Fisher, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you indeed.
A fight between a Republican governor and a Democratic legislature in Illinois has led to almost 100 days without a budget. The state now has a backlog of more than $6 billion of unpaid bills. State funding for public universities has been cut off. State museums have been closed. And now even 911 call centers are in the mix. Tony Arnold covers Illinois politics for WBEZ in Chicago. And Tony, what a mess.
What a mess. I mean, this is really affecting almost everything from the 911 call centers to STD testing that is being affected here by this budget impasse.
Well, tell us about the 911 call centers, because a lot of people are going to be quite shocked that that would be something that could be affected by a budget stalemate.
Right. 911 centers are funded through a tax on cell phones in Illinois. And what's going on is that the taxes are still being collected on cell phones. Money's coming in, but it's not going out because a budget hasn't been approved by the legislature or the governor to tell the state where to spend that money. So 911 centers have been sitting here dipping into their own reserves because they haven't been paid. They're saying we may have to lay people off. That means fewer people to answer the phones when someone calls 911, which means potentially longer wait times for anyone who calls 911.
And you mentioned also funding for STD testing not going out there. And we talked about the universities, the public universities in Illinois, not getting a dime of state funding for months.
Right. Universities are dipping into their own reserves, talking about tuition increases with STD testing. The departments of public health, the local departments, aren't being able to get reimbursed for sending their samples along to the state. Usually that's been free. We're hearing all sorts of stories about English as a second language not being funded, mental health organizations, training for police officers, even lottery winners haven't been paid.
And the governor, Bruce Rauner, the Republican governor, says he's not backing down in this budget fight with the Democratic legislature. What is at issue here? What can't they agree on?
The governor says that he's holding out for budget-related issues. He says these things are budget-related. He's talking about making workers' compensation more selective, cutting down on the number of civil lawsuits filed or tort reform, putting in term limits on legislators. But at the heart of it, a lot of what he's talking about is really anti-union proposals to limit collective bargaining, that type of thing. Democrats say that he has this obsession that the governor has with undermining unions, and that a lot of these issues aren't related to this budget at all. And this is all kind of a distraction.
How long can this fight go on?
There's really no end in sight. There's a few line of thoughts of when this might end, what could prompt this. One is that the state, as you said before, is running out of money. And so the one thing that they actually did pass a budget for is keeping the schools open. But there's been many lawsuits and court orders saying the state has to pay for payroll. No, you have to pay for foster care. You have to pay for Medicaid. These are judges saying this, telling the state they have to do this. So a lot of money is still going out the door. But they might not even have the money to pay for what they actually budgeted for, schools. So there might come a time when these two things cross and schools start not getting paid. That could prompt action. Another thing is, honestly, a lot of people are kind of sitting around thinking there might be some sort of tragedy because we're talking about police training that's getting cut. English as a second language.
911 call centers.
911 call centers. There might be a tragedy that actually spurs some kind of action from the politicians. But in the meantime, there really doesn't seem to be any sort of political will to get the two sides together.
Tony Arnold, who covers Illinois politics for WBEZ in Chicago. Tony, thank you.
Thanks, Jimmy.
This podcast is sponsored by Casper. Casper is an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support by combining premium latex foam and memory foam. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. Pick the one that is best for you and try it out, risk-free, for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/now and you can save $50. That's casper.com/now.
It's here and now. Let's turn now to Canada and the Canadian military. As fighting in northern Afghanistan heats up again, it's worth noting that until last year, Canada had soldiers there. Also, Canada is part of the U.S.-led coalition fighting ISIS in Iraq and Syria. So the idea of military cooperation between the two countries is not really new. In fact, it was the subject of a 1968 movie called The Devil's Brigade, a story of a joint U.S.-Canadian unit in World War II.
Major Crown, sir. Canadian Army. Reporting for duty.
Glad to have you with us, Crown.
Well, now we have this surprising piece of news from the CBC. The Canadian military has been in talks with the U.S. to integrate their country's military forces today. CBC reporter James Cudmore broke the story and joins us now. And James, what sort of military cooperation are we talking about?
Well, Meghna, you set the stage quite nicely talking about the cooperation that Canada and the U.S. have embarked upon in places like Afghanistan. There's also, of course, and by way of more context, the NORAD piece, which is really important in the defense of North America, which is effectively an integrated aerospace defense unit, both Canadian and American. That's kind of the model for what was being discussed and planned inside Canadian and American military headquarters. We know that Canada's chief of the defense staff at the time, General Tom Lawson, met on several occasions with your chair of the Joint Chiefs at the time, General Martin Dempsey, to discuss, and I quote here, fully integrated forces. This was one of several different options that was being looked at. This was conceptual development, according to some military documents that I got a hold of, that deal with different manners in which we could do a better job of working with one another.
Let me just jump in here because, the difference between military parlance and lay parlance can be quite dramatic. Fully integrated, meaning what?
That's a great question. Fully integrated. What does it mean? So there were a couple of different options on the table. At the extreme end was this idea of forces being unified under a single chain of command with single accountabilities and responsibilities, a regulated kind of arrangement, documented, an MOU, signed agreements, all everybody's governments agreeing to this process. That is something that would look very much like that Devil's Brigade idea, the first special service force of a joint unit. And that would be the entire force. Now, when we're talking about numbers, you should bear in mind that Canada's military is quite small in comparison to the United States. Our force is only about the size, in fact, less than the size of your Marine force. And that's all of them, our Air Force, our Navy, and our Army. So the idea of Canada kind of melding into to a U.S. force does make some kind of sense, apart from the fact that we're separate countries. There's the rub, right?
Right, of course.
So there were a couple of other options that were being discussed, which included maybe just something like a joint expeditionary unit to deploy abroad to certain hotspots. And that would be kind of a standing force, but not truly integrated, not one unit commanded by one person. It would be more like an agreed idea of how we might operate abroad. And then a third option was just how can we keep the lessons that we learned fighting alongside one another in Afghanistan going? And it appears that that's really the option that the two forces, yours and ours, landed on.
So, James, this is interesting, though, because on the one hand, perhaps greater cooperation or even integration between the United States and Canadian militaries might make strategic sense when considering, North American operations, right? I mean, you talked about NORAD, but here you're reporting that, the discussions were what the lessons that we take from Afghanistan in foreign hotspots. But on the other hand, though, I also read that while you said that the heads of the both the U.S. and Canadian militaries were in these discussions, that not other members of the Canadian government were privy to this?
Yeah, so that sure is interesting. We know that these discussions happened several times and at the highest levels inside the military. When I put this information to our government here in Canada, the government said, look, we weren't directing these discussions, and we really don't have any interest in this high-end concept of a fully integrated force. So that leads to the question of whether or not the military was completely freelancing here. I'm going to give them a little bit of credit and suggest that really what they were doing was following along the line and the lines that had already been laid out for them through pieces like NORAD and through pieces like the NATO International Security Assistance Force in Afghanistan, and also really some of the work that Canada and other allies of the United States, France and the United Kingdom and others, are doing in Iraq and Syria, for instance. There is this move toward integrated coalition forces. Mm-hmm. How do you make that work?
Mm-hmm. Interesting, yes. Because I see in your reporting you say that that the Defense Department says that the planning for this began as an attempt to maintain lessons learned from joint operations in Afghanistan. But on the other hand, I do have to wonder, how do Canadians react to this? Because I think, if I can just quote your own piece to you, very elegantly written, that this kind of bilateral relationship is described by some as akin to sharing a bed with an elephant.
Yeah, I have to give credit where it's due. That came from a former prime minister, a guy called Pierre Trudeau. And that was what he said. And that is the idea that we hold here in terms of our relationship, both economically as well as militarily. The reality is when it comes to the military piece, Canada is a very small contributor, important but small contributor to the defense of North America. The defense of North America has become a really important thing for the United States following those horrible attacks in September of 2001. And the military response by the United States to create something like the U.S. NORTHCOM arrangement, the combatant command responsible for North America, that kind of swallowed up NORAD, which is this binational North American aerospace defense unit, that's really what led to this this move to see if there might be further integration, for instance, at sea in the defense of our maritime approaches, and then why not abroad? It seems that that abroad piece is really the hardest one for people to come to grips with, the integration of land forces, right? There's so much esprit de corps inside these land units. You know about how somebody never really leaves the Marines. They're always a Marine for the rest of their life, and people are very proud of belonging to these units and to these organizations and fighting for their country, those sorts of things. And this is why maybe in the long run, the idea of a future Devil's Brigade probably isn't something that would ever come to be. Mm. But we are seeing things like the UK-led Joint Expeditionary Force, which has a few Nordic countries and Northern European countries linking up with the United Kingdom in order to come up with some kind of a force of like-minded countries to go abroad and to fight abroad if necessary in order to kind of share the burden. It's really kind of like NATO in a tighter application, I suppose.
But just to be clear, at this point in time, at least, fully integrating the U.S. and Canadian militaries is not on the table anymore.
That's what they say.
That's what they say. Okay. Well, the question remains then. But finally, James, I'm curious. Can you talk to us about the political aspects of this? Because Canada is gearing up for an election that could determine whether or not Prime Minister Stephen Harper remains as PM. I mean, how much is defense and national security part of the election in there?
We are talking about some of these issues, national security, quite regularly on what's been a 12-week campaign coming to a close on October 19th. Ours are more limited duration than kind of the perennial campaign, or at least the years-long campaign for the White House that we see in the United States.
That's putting gently. interminable campaign is more like it.
And so the conversations are much more intense and more focused, and they happen over a smaller period of time. And we're hearing a lot of conversation around the idea of terrorism, and protecting Canada or the homeland, to use that American word, from terrorists, from people abroad. And it's probably important to remember that it wasn't that long ago, October 22nd, well, very nearly a year ago, that there was an attack in Ottawa by a lone terrorist, is the word that's been used, who attacked our parliament. Well, our prime minister and our ministers and all of our members of parliament were meeting inside the building in their separate caucus rooms. He also killed a soldier standing guard at the National War Memorial in Ottawa. So these ideas of sort of ISIS sympathizers, people who might be interested in doing harm to us in the name of the so-called Islamic State, is a live one over the course of our election campaign. But we don't have a very mature discussion of these issues in Canada during the electoral time frame. We're not talking about what a force should look like or what sort of operation somebody should be doing abroad. And indeed, since the election period began, we've heard very little from our own Department of National Defense about the war that we are currently fighting alongside the U.S. Against ISIS in Iraq and in Syria.
Well, James Cudmore is a senior reporter with the CBC's Parliamentary Bureau. James, many thanks.
You got it.
And according to the latest report from the U.S. Drought Monitor, 99.86% of California is in some level of drought. 46% of the state is in the highest level of drought. Now, the good news is that Californians have cut their water use by 27% in the month of August. That is the third straight month that residents and businesses met the state's goals to cut water usage in the face of this four-year drought. But even conservation would not help the giant sequoia trees in California's Sequoia National Park. Scientists have discovered that many of the trees, which have survived for centuries of drought, fire, and insect invasions, are showing visible signs of exhaustion. Anthony Ambrose is a tree biologist with the University of California, Berkeley. He actually climbs into the sequoias to place sensors and measure their health, and he joins us now. Anthony, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And for people who've never seen a giant sequoia tree, can you describe it for us?
Giant sequoia trees are one of the most amazing trees in the world. They are the largest organism in the world, not counting clonal species. They have these huge, massive orange trunks that just pop out from the landscape. They're way bigger than anything else growing around them. They have these big, massive, sprawling crowns with huge limbs, and they're hundreds of feet tall and thousands of years old. There's just these just beautiful, beautiful trees.
And I know that you and your team examined the sequoias in the Sierra Nevadas just a couple of weeks ago, but what did you find? What's the update at this point?
Well, the giant sequoia trees over the last 2 years have been showing some signs of drought stress. They've been shedding a lot of foliage, more than normal. Not all trees are showing these signs, but a lot of them are. And so we went and measured the water status of the trees and collected some leaf samples to analyze their chemical signatures, and found that a lot of the trees are quite stressed, more stressed than we've seen in the past. But it's highly variable. So some trees are showing signs of stress and some trees are not.
And are things still getting worse as compared to when you went up there, let's say, in August?
Yeah. When we first started climbing the trees at the beginning of the summer, a lot of the trees that were not showing signs of stress were showing them later on in the season when we went back for our measurements. We think that the shedding of the foliage is a mechanism that the trees are responding to the drought by reducing their leaf area that's losing water to the atmosphere.
And over the life of these trees, because these are very old trees, you're saying this has never happened in the past, or we just don't know?
Well, yeah, you're correct that these trees, they live thousands of years. They've undoubtedly dealt with pretty severe droughts in the past and other disturbances such as fires. But the level of foliage dieback that's being observed this year and last year has never been observed in the park's 125-year history. So it is definitely unusual, and there hasn't been any historical evidence of such an event like this in the past.
Is there anything that you can do to help them, to alleviate their stress, or does it just – we have to wait until it starts raining in California?
Well, the park is really interested in getting a better understanding of which trees on the landscape and which areas are more or less vulnerable to drought stress, because they can use that information to prioritize management activities such as prescribed fire to thin out some of the understory trees and reduce some of the competition for limited soil water availability.
Is what's happening to the sequoias different than what's happening to any other tree in California? Would you be able to see this same kind of thing on a tree that doesn't live for 3,000 years?
Well, a lot of trees in California are really suffering from this current drought, and even within the giant sequoia groves, there are other species that are actually dying, pines and firs and cedars in particular in the Sierra Nevada, that are actually there's whole swaths, particularly at lower elevations, that are actually dying. So, you know, they're more vulnerable to bark beetles and other types of pests that drought weakens the trees. The giant sequoias are tougher than these other species, so we're optimistic that they'll be able to hang through this where some of the other trees are dying.
What is it that you can learn from a giant sequoia that you can't learn from any other tree?
That's a good question. Well, you know, each species handles the environment and drought stress in this example differently. Different trees have different ways of coping and adapting to the environment and the conditions that they face. And so, you know, giant sequoias are a good example of a very tough and resistant tree, and being able to learn how they are able to deal with these types of events helps us understand how they can live for thousands of years and get to be so big and large.
Dr. Anthony Ambrose is a researcher with the University of California, Berkeley. He's been climbing up these giant sequoia trees in the Sierras to see how they're responding to the drought. Dr. Ambrose, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is Here and Now.